You know the feeling when your mate's golf ball flies past yours? Or when you're on the green in regulation, but he holds it from the bunker? At Drummond Golf, we get it. That's why we have our lowest price guarantee. As Australia's biggest, you can count on our massive buying power for the lowest prices in golf. But if you do happen to find a lower advertised price, we'll beat it. The Drummond Golf lowest price guarantee. Unbeatable. Conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to episode 109 of The Thing About Golf, the podcast series from Golf Australia magazine trying to answer that impossible question. What is it that gets people so hooked on this ridiculous game? Rod Murray's my name and I'm joined on the line by my colleague John Huggan to help introduce this episode. And Huggy, this is one for the real golf nerds, many of whom, like me, I suspect, knew very little about this guest previously, but now will feel like they should have known more. Tell us how you came to know Vinnie Giles.
Well, I can't sort of say that I know Vinnie Giles that well, but this is I'm not one given to hero worship very often in golf. I mean, maybe Seve and, you know, the absolute elite players, but Vinnie Giles, I mean, I played a lot of high-level amateur golf a long, long time ago, and Vinnie Giles was always one of my heroes. I thought Vinnie Giles was just the business. I mean, the way he played, he's one of these guys that made the absolute maximum of everything he had. A gritty, sort of, you know, hard-to-beat guy, hard as nails. The sort of guy that you'd look at him on the first tee, I would imagine, and you think, man, I need to play well today to beat this guy. He was never going to give you anything. And he's great. I mean, he's a terrific talker, much to my glee. I really enjoyed talking to him, but yes, I have to admit this was a purely hero worship thing for me.
I haven't listened to the whole thing yet. I've listened to probably half of it. There's a real Chicago sort of hard man thing about him, isn't there? Like you say, you'd step on the first tee, you might actually be a little bit scared.
I was heartened to hear that he's a cynical old sod, and he's not. I found myself thinking, well, I've got a fair bit in common with this guy. He's not the, you know, for all that he's a terrific, you know, in amateur golf, which is the kind of, you know, establishment-like look about it, if you like. He's hardly that. I mean, he's kept the establishment at arm's length his whole life, and I was heartened again to find out that he's a cynical old sod, a bit like myself, and he had nothing much good to say about the USGA's performance in certain matters over the year. And like, this is the interesting thing for me, is that like so many, you know, elite players at amateur level, and even guys who've turned pro, and you're talking years and years before, that he's still bitter about not making one team. You know, he wasn't picked to play for America, whatever it was. I can't remember now, but probably an Eisenhower trophy, something like that. And he's still bitter about it, which is, I love all that stuff.
That's fantastic. Just for the listeners, this doesn't go for 3 hours, and it's not just Huggy and Vinny taking shots at the establishment, even though it probably sounds like it might have been. Of course, that's what I knew Vinny Giles, and not particularly well, for terrific player. You know, you've read the name, you know he's got a great record. Had this whole other life, which I didn't really know about, as a manager of professionals, and did that in a very similar fashion. I was fascinated by some of this stuff.
Yeah, he was playing. He played alongside the likes of Gary Koch and Tom Kite and those guys, and ended up being their agents once these guys turned pro. Tom Kite, in particular, I think, and Gary Koch certainly had a very long relationship, professional relationship and personal. I think I touched on that in the Gary Koch podcast that we did, because I'd looked up a US Open that Gary Koch had played in, obviously, early in his professional career, and there was his agent who'd beaten him in the US Open.
It's an awkward conversation on Monday, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think Gary paid Vinny the sort of ultimate compliment, really, was when he said if it had Vinny turned pro, he would be in the Hall of Fame now. I'm not sure Vinny quite agrees with that, but it's quite clear that he was one hell of a player.
They're rare, aren't they, Huggy? The career amateur who is good enough but doesn't turn it. Yeah, it's rare, isn't it?
With Vinny, I think he just didn't fancy the lifestyle.
Yeah,
it was as simple as that. I think he married quite young and was quite happy to do what he's done. I mean, and my goodness, it's been a lot.
Yeah, well, fantastic. Well, it's a lovely chat and it's a really interesting chat. We'll get to it now. Thanks for joining us to intro it, Huggy.
My pleasure.
Okay, welcome to the latest edition of the Thing About Golf podcast. I've actually got one of my heroes as a guest this week. One of the best amateurs of certainly the last 50 years at either side of the Atlantic, Vinnie Giles. What was and is the thing about golf for you?
John, the thing about golf for me, I think, is it's sort of been my life. I started playing golf when I was 5 years old. I've competed actually since I was probably eight. And, you know, even though I did not turn professional, played amateur golf most of my life and really didn't turn professionally primarily because I was scared golf wouldn't be fun anymore. I'd talked to several people who had played the tour and didn't really enjoy it. I'll never forget listening to Billy Casper complain about the fact it was nothing but a job. It was eight to six every day and practice and no life for himself. And as you know, I sort of made golf my life after finishing law school. I spent about 4 years in the securities business and then decided to start a golf sports agency in 1973. So for 40 more years, golf was my life. It was a big part of my life and primarily representing some wonderful players. I know you mentioned you spoke with Gary Koch yesterday.
Yep.
Gary Koch has been a client of mine, and I say mine because after I retired from the business, I continued to do his work and his NBC television contract work. And, you know, I'm looking back, if you start at age five and I'm now 80, I've had 75 years where golf was a big part of my life. Not my life, but a big part of my life. So that's kind of what golf is to me.
Yeah. Well, you've preempted the obvious first question, which I was going to ask you. It was why didn't you turn pro? But I'll turn that around a little bit. Have you ever had any regrets about that decision?
I have had regrets only from one standpoint, and that is I never found out if I was as good as maybe I thought I was. I mean, you know, people said, oh, you'd have been a great player. You'd have won majors. You'd have done this. But you never know till you put that peg in the ground and face some of the ups and downs of the game. And, you know, standing over that three-footer on the 72nd hole to win an Open or a U.S. Open or a Masters or a PGA, you just don't know because you never did it. And I'll always regret not knowing how good I might have been.
Everybody I've talked to, it was pretty unanimous, though. I mean, Curtis Strange told me that you'd have been in the Hall of Fame if you'd turned pro.
Well,
Gary Koch told me that yesterday that you would have won tournaments and been successful. I mean, they're saying that because they're your friends partly, but they seem pretty genuine about it.
Well, you know, I will say in the 60s and 70s, I mean, I didn't think many people were any better than I was. I had a record, the record I'm most proud of that nobody really ever knows about. Is for a seven-year stretch starting in 1967, I had one finish in the U.S. Amateur Championship worse than third. I finished...
That was when it was stroke play.
Stroke play the whole time. I finished second three times. I finished third twice. I finished first once. And the 1 year I finished out of the top three, I finished sixth.
What went wrong?
Lanny Watkins played better than I did, and so did Tom Kite, and I don't know who the other three were.
Okay. Yeah, so I mean, that all leads me to believe that you would have been good enough. You must know that.
Well,
Forget the modesty part of this.
Come on. You know, I think so. Yeah. But you, as I say, you honest to goodness do not know until you put the peg in the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what were the highlights after you'd made the decision to do what you did?
Well,
what were the highlights?
The highlights.
What was the path you were going to take? Well, probably more than we'll get to the highlights later.
I mean, I didn't really know. I decided, you know, I had played golf at the University of Georgia in college. I had actually finished second in the U.S., the NCAA championship to Bob Murphy. I'd won my share. And I won my first Virginia State Amateur when I was 19, right after I finished my first year at Georgia. But I didn't know what I was going to do. I got married right out of college. And at that point in time, we discussed the tour.
What did your wife think?
She didn't really think the lifestyle would be great. I laughed because she said, I really don't want to spend the rest of my life in a Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
And now when I do a talk or something, I will say, you know, little did she know that the Holiday Inn back there was about a 4-star. We'd have been in the Motel 6.
Right.
So,
okay. Yeah.
There wasn't any money in the game then. I mean, the total purses when I got out of college in 1966 was $6.5 million. These guys won't show up for a $6.5 million tournament today. And my God, now they won't show up for one less than $20 million. Yeah. So it's different. I mean, as you know, you're around it all the time. I mean, I hate to say it, but the game's all about money today.
Yeah.
This live thing's all about money. Everything's all about money in the game. And it makes no sense. It's taken a lot of the charm out of the game, I think.
Yeah. It was a quality of life decision.
I think it was maybe a quality of life, but more what's the future? And I decided, to be honest, I'd played golf most of my time in college.
Yeah.
I did fine in school, but I didn't work at it very hard. And so I decided to go to law school. And the reason I went to law school wasn't to practice law. It was to learn something.
Yeah.
And I will say law school to me is the best experience I ever had because it teaches you how to do things other than practice law. And then in 73, I had, people like Gary Koch, Alan Miller, who played a Walker Cup, or two, started asking me if I would help them with some of their contract work. It's funny. They'd come to you and say, well, you're a lawyer and you're in the investment business, so you must really know about everything we need. I didn't know a damn thing. but
you were following the kind of McCormack model.
Yeah. So we were dabbling in helping them. And in 73, I said to a friend of mine who also worked with me in the securities business, I said, we're 30 years old. We can take a shot at this. If it doesn't work by the time we're 35, we're not old enough where we can't do something else.
Yeah.
So we started Pros Incorporated in 73, and in 75 we signed Koch, Pate, and Burns.
Right. All from the same Walker Cup team.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3 in the Q School.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden the Mark McCormicks of the world realized, hey, these guys are for real. Hmm. And we structured a model, to be very, very honest, and I have great respect for what McCormick and IMG did. I didn't like the way they did it.
What specifically?
Well, it was who's number one. It was a numbers game. Hmm. I remember the old game they used to have, you had 25 squares and a 25-box thing, and you tried to work it around from 1 to 24.
Right.
And I said, we want these guys to be our friends first and our clients second. Right. And we want to be personal service, and we want to be small.
See, that runs against the old cliche that never get into business with your friends, but you've bucked that trend.
Well, I will say, and today, I mean, I see no loyalty with players and agents.
Yeah.
I mean, Gary Koch, I've been working with Gary Koch now since 1975.
Have you ever got written down on paper, or is it a handshake deal?
It's a handshake deal.
Yeah.
I mean, even when we sold our business in 1999, and I stayed for about 7 years and then stopped, and I actually wrote a note to two or three players and said, I've gotten the Octagon to agree that if you all want me to help, keep helping you, that I can do that. I have a non-compete.
Right.
But you're exempt from the non-compete. And, I've worked with Lanny Watkins, Bobby Watkins, Gary Koch ever since. Mm-hmm. It was a great loyalty factor. We had really good people.
Who were some of your other clients?
Davis Love, who we worked with from his dad, paid me the biggest compliment I've ever been paid in the industry. And he called me one day and said, I need you to come to Sea Island and sit down with Davis and his mother and myself. And Davis is not going to go back to Chapel Hill for his last year,
right.
But nobody knows that. He hadn't told the coach yet, and I don't want anybody else to touch him but you. I don't want IMG or whomever. I just want him. I want you because I know you'll look out for him. And
that is a compliment.
Yeah, well, it's the best compliment that I ever had in the business. And we, you know, Davis and I have been great friends, and you know, I still see him a lot. In fact, I just did a deal for him a couple months ago.
Well, so you haven't retired quite yet.
He said, what is your commission? I said, Davis, I'm not going to charge you a commission. I'm out of the business.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. Yeah. I mean, I actually on Davis Love's father, I was at Golf Digest at the time he went down the awful plane crash, and I actually wrote the last story he ever did.
Did you?
For the magazine.
So. Well, he was a wonderful man, and I will say till my dying day that had he not died, Davis Love would have won more majors and more tournaments because
I'm sure that's true.
Davis Sr. wouldn't have let him hunt and fish and do all the things he loved to do. He'd have made him work on his golf game.
He was quite
a
strict taskmaster, wasn't
yes,
he?
Yes, sir. Sure was.
Absolutely. So you've touched on it already, but I mean, how has the business of agency and golf evolved over all the years that you did it?
Well, as I say, I mean, I always felt like there was a certain amount of respect for others in the business. I can't say that I had that respect for IMG because they would poach a client in a heartbeat if they thought they could. And I had instances where I actually had confrontations with a couple of their agents just because they were approaching our clients.
Did you lose people?
No, I don't think we
see. That's the ultimate compliment to you, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, I really felt like, for the most part, if Gary Koch was my client, they were not going to try to interfere. Mm-hmm. Today, I mean, it's, you know, God only knows what their offers they're throwing at. You know, if you're getting charged 16%, we'll do it for 12.
Yeah.
It's that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a numbers game. Man, there are people charging 7%, 8%. Our standard fees in the old days were 20%.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't charge. The one thing that got McCormick so upset is when we started the business, we said, we're not going to charge on prize money. He was charging a percentage of prize money. Yeah, I said, hell, I can't make a four-footer for these guys for $20,000 or $200,000 or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not going to charge them for that.
That's a fair point.
So then everybody else, they're not charging, so we're not paying you anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, in my line of business, the dealing with agents, I've had a varied experiences, as you can imagine. Some I could see far enough. Some of them are really good. You know, the Peter Malik, who deals with Curtis Strange, is a terrific guy. But there's others who shall remain nameless that I could see far enough.
No, they don't want you to get close to them.
No.
They don't want you to be their friend.
Yeah.
They want to own them, basically.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I've gotten players into trouble by bypassing the agent.
Oh.
And knowing the player well enough to phone them up and
say, absolutely.
And that gets them into trouble.
Yeah. I mean, now it's crazy. I mean, you see them now, God, they're on the practice team. You go to a presentation, they're holding a hand.
Yeah.
I mean, if I were giving out credentials, I wouldn't give them a credential.
No.
Said you can get any closer than outside the ropes on the third hole.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's amazing. They stand and watch them hit balls.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, now they've got an entourage. It's almost like the old boxers.
Yeah.
You got your brain man and your swing man and your physio and your this and your that. I'm thinking, good God. Mm-hmm. If they need you, they'll call you.
Yeah.
Leave them alone.
Exactly. Anyway, I'm going to take you back to the point where you're not turning pro. You're going to do what you're going to do. Talk me as to what kind of career playing golf that you saw at that point, and did it fulfill everything that, your competitive side of your nature?
No, it did not, and it did not, and I'll be very candid with you, and I haven't talked about this a lot, but my only goal, well, quite honestly, my only goal after, let's say I won the amateur in 72, played Walker Cup through 75, played my last world amateur in 72. My only real goal was to try to continue to make Walker Cup team.
Right.
I mean, I felt like I could play enough. I couldn't play a full schedule.
No.
I mean, I never played in tournaments like the Western Amateur just because of one, it was expensive, and two, it was time consuming.
Yeah.
But in 75, I won the British Amateur after the Walker Cup.
Yeah.
And I had pretty good successes in other events after that. A couple of wins, some seconds, in major amateur tournaments. Yeah. And I did not make the 77 Walker Cup team.
Why was that?
I was at the least, I was the fifth best amateur player on record in the country.
Yeah.
The USGA, I had taken a shot at the USGA about going from stroke play to match play.
Right.
And my argument there was, I think match play is wonderful, but to determine a national champion, it's not the best format.
No.
And I went back and I gave them evidence. If you went back and looked at the top 10 finishers at stroke play, six, seven, eight of them would have been what you call pre-tournament favorites.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you go back and look at the quarterfinalists at match play, I mean, there were a bunch of names you never heard of.
Well, I can give you evidence of that. The 1985 British Amateur at Royal Dornoch, there was one absolute chopper made the quarterfinal that year.
Yeah, there you go.
He had no chance.
No names mentioned. He just happened to be sitting here.
Yeah, that's right.
But anyway, I got sideways with them because Golf World asked me to be interviewed, and I did. And I told them exactly what I thought. Well, then Sandy Tatum, who I think at the time was the president of the USGA and an arrogant so-and-so, he demanded equal time to defend the other position.
Okay.
And we took a poll at the Porter Cup Championship, which back then was probably the top amateur invitation tournament in the country. And there were 90 players. The question was, do you think the U.S. amateur should be stroke play or match play? 88 stroke play, one match play, and one no opinion.
Right.
We presented it to the USGA.
Yeah.
Mr. Tatum's response was, this is not the players' championship, this is our championship. Tatum politicked me off the team, and I knew that.
Yeah, it's funny how, I mean, I played at a reasonable level at amateur golf, and no matter who you speak to, and you being a perfect example of somebody who achieved so much, you're still pissed off about one team that you didn't get into.
Yeah.
Everybody's got one team.
And I'll tell you, that pretty much ended my playing amateur competitive golf.
Yeah.
I had young children and a brand new business. And I said, if politics are going to be how you pick these teams.
It's almost that way.
Because I'm never going to be simpatico with the USGA unless something changes.
Yeah. Mind you, you can never win against the establishment.
No, you can't, but you take your toys and go home.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to fight that fight.
Yeah. Mind you, it's the same on the other side. I would argue, and I've written this, that the GB and I, Great Britain and Ireland team in the Walker Cup, I don't think they've ever picked the best team.
Right.
Because there's ones from each country fighting for their own guys, and they never.
The best
team was 10 Englishmen. That wouldn't be the team.
Yeah,
No,
you're right. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. We, as you can imagine, back when they got into this territorial thing, all the best tournaments are played on the East Coast. The West Coast guys don't really have a chance to show.
Yeah,
and it was true because there were a lot of good players in California, but they played mostly on the West Coast.
Yeah, I mean, it still happens today. I mean, I don't really know anything about this, but I'm reading about the lad who lost in the final of the US Amateur this year.
Yeah.
He's a bit wild. He's got long hair. He says stuff, and he's not here.
I said to Mike McCoy, I said, when the final picks came out, I said, it's a damn shame that big boy ain't going to be on the team because it'd be a lot more fun in the locker room.
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't know him at all, and I didn't realize how strong a summer he'd had. But the comment I got from somebody who was involved was that, well, he had one nice stretch in a short period of time where these other guys had a greater body of work.
Right.
No, there were. I mean, there were a lot of people that felt just like you did that he certainly deserved to be picked over a couple of people that were.
Yeah, let's talk about your Walker Cups. I've talked to you before about 2 years, 1971 and 1975, both here at St Andrews, for stories that I've written. But I do want you to tell the story about the one piece of golfing memorabilia that people can see in your house and tell that story.
Well, in 71, and I don't think this would have happened if we had won, but because we lost, it helped. On the 17th hole, I hold a shot out of the road against Sir Michael Benalik. Total fluke. I mean, just pounded. I popped it out of the road. It jumped up on the green. It hit the flagstick, and it went in the hole. Michael had about a 5 or 6 foot putt for a four, which was going to win the hole, it looked like.
Yeah.
And one of the few times I've ever seen him show any emotion, when my ball went in the hole, he actually dropped his putter, and his putt didn't come close.
Right, yeah.
And I ended up winning the match one up. And Keith McKenzie, who at the time was the secretary of the R&A, who was had gotten to be a good pal of mine and was a sweet man. I mean, he was one of my favorite people in the world. Took the flagstick, cut it in half, brought it to the U.S., had it soldered back together, and presented it to me at the amateur dinner at the Masters in 72. And I don't have any golf things in above basement level in my house.
Right.
But that flagstick we put up on the wall in the family room, and it's still my U.S. amateur trophy, I guess, is my favorite single thing. But that one's a close second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Michael Benalik's been on this podcast, and it would be a stretch to say that he's bitter about that shot, but he hasn't forgotten it. That's for sure.
No, he really hadn't. And it's funny because when we were over here, I think for the 19 at Hoy Lake.
Yeah, 19.
We went to Michael and Angela's house for dinner with Danny and Lois Yates, and Michael still looks at me kind of funny. There's not a lot of warmth there. We're good friends, but that has now. You're right. It's never been forgotten.
No. I mean, it's outrageous, really. Yeah. I mean,
I thought one of the papers, the Scotsman or something, you know, back then they had great coverage of the Walker Cup in big galleries and what have you. And the headline was, "A most dastardly act." And everybody's talked about it was a great shot. It wasn't a great shot. It was blind luck.
Yeah.
The flagstick got in the way.
Yeah.
It was that simple. Yeah, yeah. I had no chance. I was going to lose it.
Well, if I'm Michael Benalik, I'm sitting there thinking, I've got two putts to win this hole.
Absolutely. You know? Or three.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I was going to probably give it to him.
Well, yeah. Because where was the ball going to finish up?
At the best, it was going to be in the bunker.
Right,
and then you got no shot anyway.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a good story. That 71 Walker Cup is the only one that the U.S. lost between 1938 and 1989.
Yeah.
Now, I've spoken for the story I did. I spoke to Lanny Watkins and Tom Kite, who were both part of that team, as you were, and they still can't believe it. I mean, it still lives with them.
Oh,
for all that they went on to achieve in golf, that still bothers them.
Well, that was one of those years and that's why I think, I've always said, I think that's why we came back here in 75.
Yeah.
Because they
thought might win again.
These stupid Americans don't know how to play the old course. I mean, I hated the golf course.
Really?
The first time, the first whole Walker Cup. I said, what in God's name is this? And literally, when we came over in 75, played our first practice round. I hit a tee shot on 14 that I thought was perfect. And it took about six left bounces and went into a pot bunker.
Yeah.
And I took my wedge and jumped in the bunker and hit the ball and went home that night. And I'm lying in bed and I'm saying, you know, you got to be a dumb SOB. And I started thinking about it. And I said, nothing to this golf course. Hit it left. Yeah. Just hit it
all,
left.
All day long. Yeah.
And, you know, from I just fell in love with it immediately. Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And if you know, that's why I've been coming back from, as often as I could. Because mm-hmm. It's just fun.
Yeah.
At Drummond Golf, we understand your passion.
Nice roll.
And that's because every Drummond Golf store is owned and run by a local who loves the game as much as you do.
Yeah, it's come off the face really well.
Someone who knows where you play and what you need.
Oh yeah, looking good.
With Australia's biggest range and expert knowledge.
Great. Now let's try that putter with this grip.
So if you want to improve your game, see your local expert at Drummond Golf.
How big of a deal was it winning our amateur? If I can
tell you the truth, it was a kind of a surprise. I had not been playing very well when we came over here, and I spent a lot of time trying to iron out some things. Mm-hmm. And played okay in the Walker Cup, but not great. I mean, I had such a good partner in Gary Koch that you know, we played four foursomes matches together, and I think we won 7-5 at Brookline.
Right. This was in 73.
73.
Yeah.
And I felt like if I could get Gary Koch on a green, I could go to the next tee because he was going to either make it or almost make it.
Amazing
every
putter.
Time.
Oh, yeah.
Phenomenal putter. Yeah. And we went to Hoylake. I got very lucky because I got a bye in the first round, and the weather was just brutal. It was 45 degrees. Yeah. It was blowing 25, and it was raining sideways.
Yeah.
I remember watching Sir Michael on the first tee, and he would look up and wipe his face. And I don't remember a whole lot about any of the matches that I played other than the semifinals and the finals. But I just got to playing better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I mean, back then, I could get it up and down from
yeah,
garbage.
That's
game.
What I was told, yes. Yeah. Yes.
And I can't anymore. It's hard now.
Yeah.
But
you beat a good player in the final.
Yeah, yeah.
As it turned out, Mark James.
Mark James, he'd had a great Walker Cup. I think he was Pate's nemesis all during the Walker Cup. Yeah. But, you know, it just sort of fell together. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, when you've committed yourself, I was 32 at the time, and you've sort of committed yourself to being an amateur.
Yeah.
You're kind of running out of things you want
to
do.
Well, no, it's impressive to, you know, to have won both.
Yeah.
You know, not many people have done that.
No.
I'm not sure how many, but it's not many.
Not many. I think it's less than 10.
Yeah.
And modern time. Of course, you know, nobody plays and stays amateur long enough to
play
anymore.
Well, that's true, too, yeah.
I mean, the amateur over here now, you know, you're going to have more Italians and Swedes and whatever you win than Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's happening already. Yeah.
But, I mean, it was a big deal because I knew it was, you know, time was coming. I mean, I was on the downstroke of playing a lot of really top golf. I mean, the college players, as you know, dominate the game.
Yeah.
That was what made it so much fun. It was fun beating them.
Yeah.
Because they didn't like it.
I'm sure.
What was this old guy doing beating us?
Yeah. And the way that you played, I mean, you mentioned your short game. I mean, that's, I'm surprised to hear you. Slightly surprised to hear you stick up for stroke play as much as that, because you're the perfect game for match play.
I love match play. I think match play has a gigantic, I mean, it's the way we play golf most of the time. It does not identify the best champion. When you look at American golf today, you have 200 college players that are probably capable of playing the PGA Tour.
Yeah.
Now, you go out and you shoot 65, 68 in the qualifying, and you finish first or second. Excuse me. You go out in your first match, you shoot 67, and you play some guy that holds a bunch of putts, he shoots 66, and you're on the way home.
Yeah.
And you probably had a five-shot lead in stroke
play. Yeah. The other side of the coin is, and I stick up for match play to this extent, in that in stroke play to me only really becomes interesting when it turns into match play near the end.
Well, that's a good point. You know? That's a good point. But it's a little bit of shadow boxing. There's no question about it. But at the same time, I just feel like if you play the best over 72 holes, you probably deserve to win.
Yeah.
If you can get, and I've always said in match play too, John, that you got to get by with one round you don't play very well.
Yes.
That the other
you always
guy,
get a break.
Yeah, the other guy plays a little worse than you do. Mm-hmm. But to watch a guy go out and shoot, and I've seen it in some of my later amateur, seven over, six over, five over, and win three matches in a row, and all of a sudden he gets to the semifinals or something and starts playing well. But he shouldn't have ever been there.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't deserve to be there.
You mentioned that 75 amateur that you won, the weather. I remember reading in the Scotsman newspaper, Norman Mayer was was a great journalist back then, and he wrote, he talked to somebody about a match that he just won on the last green, and the guy said, "Oh man," he says, "it was really tight," he says, "and then I started throwing sixes and sevens at him and he had no answer." You know, it was that bad, you know. So that rings true. I mean, I was looking at your record, Vinny. Why did you never play an hour open? I'm sure you were exempt a couple of times.
Mainly finances.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I actually came over, I think it was 76. I can't remember what kind of exemption they gave you back then, whether it was 1 year or 2 years.
I think you'd have gotten in the next Open by winning the amateur.
Yeah, but I remember coming over here for business to Birkdale. Mm-hmm. Might have been 76.
That would be, yeah. It'd be Seve when Seve appeared.
Right, and it was a 400, 800, 900 degrees down there. And nobody had any air conditioning. And I went to get a fan. They'd sold out of fans.
It was
a long week. But, as I say, it was primarily just, leaving work for more than a week.
Yeah, I thought just once.
I know. I mean, hindsight, I wish I'd done it. Yeah. I made a mistake. I've made plenty of mistakes in my life.
I wanted to talk to you also about the Masters. I know you've been leading amateur there. The first question that came to my mind was, what the hell is it like sitting in that butler cabin, that terrible ceremony that they have at the end?
The year I was low amateur, the first year I played, it was 1968, I'd finished second in the amateur, U.S. amateur the year before. And, I was in law school. I wasn't playing any golf. I went down, I left Charlottesville, Virginia. I was going to go down. We had Saturday classes. And I said, as soon as Saturday class is over, I'm going to go down. I woke up Thursday morning, and I said, I can't stand it any longer. I don't know what my professors are going to think, but I'm going. And I left. We played and played with Sidorov, Crenshaw, I forgot, Gary Coe. We had a bunch of them. We just played golf. We played the par three. And anyway, I go out first round, and I make about a 30-footer on the first hole for a birdie. Hit a drive over nine fairway, made birdie. I made a 40-footer on five. I made another long putt somewhere, and I shoot 3-under on the front. And I'm walking off the green, and there's an announcer there. And he says, leading the Masters at this point. I said, Jesus.
Yeah.
I hit 8 greens on the backside and shot 38. But made the cut and continued to play solid. I think I shot even par for the four rounds. I was really excited to go to the butler cabin.
Yeah.
Till I found out that
was an odd year, though, 68.
Well, I was just getting ready to say, I found out that DeVincenzo signed the wrong scorecard.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, all this buzz and carrying on. And so Bobby Jones said, doesn't make any difference. That's what he shot. We're going to give him that score. USGA, of course, said, rightly.
I'm just going to ask you, where do you fall on that?
No, it was right. I mean, I can't believe Tommy Aaron could have written the wrong score down.
I know.
Good God. How many people saw it? And that's the argument you make. Hey, they were – X million viewers saw it. And I was also told that they hustled, you know, all they had was a table behind the 18th. And they hustled him down to the press room. He didn't have much time. He spoke very broken English. And, but, you know, all of a sudden, here's what happened. And now he comes in, and I don't think a lot of people, John, heard this. It's somebody, you know, said something. His comment was, what a stupid I am. And then sort of under his breath, I just happened to be close enough to him. But in my country, what you shoot is what you get.
I'm on his team on that.
Well, I think it's terrible. I mean, I honestly think you do video replay on the ball, guys, moving, et cetera. Can't you go back and say, okay, one hit, he was two hit, he was three in the hole?
I
think that's overdone. I understand the responsibility of the player.
I wrote a column years ago, and I'll see what you think of this. It was very slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I actually think that Bob Golby missed an opportunity that day. If Bob Golby had said, no, I'm not having this, we're going to play off tomorrow.
If he could have.
Well, if he just said no, what would they have done? Would they give it to the third guy? Because De Vicenza wouldn't have taken it. Yeah. He said, well, let's play off tomorrow. And for Bob Golby, my point was that there was two possibilities for Bob Golby the next day. He was either going to be the Masters champion and the sportsman of the century, or just the sportsman of the century.
It was horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't any fun.
Well, you saw it up close.
It took all the fun out of it. The rules are the rules. I know you're supposed to play by them. And I think they probably did what they had to do, but not necessarily what they should have done. I guess I'd put it that way.
Right. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I want to talk about we're beaten to death the fact that you didn't turn pro. I mean, who were the best amateurs that you played with?
You know, I played back when I first started playing, there were a lot of career amateurs. I would say the best one I ever played with, and it was way late in life, was probably Harvey Ward.
Right, yeah.
Harvey Ward, he won the first big tournament I ever saw he won. It was a U.S. Amateur at the Country Club of Virginia in Richmond, where I now live.
Right.
And 1955, and he beat Bill Hindman's by some god-awful score, 11-10 or that. And I watched every shot. And I played a fair amount with Harvey later on when he was a lot older. But they said he was one of the top five players in the world, pro or amateur, in that time frame. As amateurs, I mean, Crenshaw was really, really good. Mm-hmm. You saw my comments on Pate. I mean, there were certain guys that had that it factor. Lanny Watkins, I played a ton with.
One of the
reasons Lanny's always been so respectful of me is we played three times head to head, and he's 0-3.
Really?
Two state amateurs and one north-south amateur semifinal.
That's quite something.
And, he'll bring it up. I never beat you. I mean, beat me a ton of stroke play.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
But Lanny, and I looked at guys like Bob Murphy back when, and then Lanny, and then Pete. They were cocky as hell. And you have to be in that game. Mm-hmm. I mean, Lanny walked right after he qualified. He'd walk right on that practice tee and put his clubs down between Nicklaus and Palmer. Say, come on, boys.
Yeah.
Bring it on.
Yeah. Well, he definitely had that in him.
Show me if you can beat me. I used to say, Lanny Watkins, if you gave him a one iron, as we're going way back with one iron, you gave him a one iron to a pin tucked over water in the corner of a green with a brick wall between him and the hole, he'd swear to you could hit it through the brick wall and knock it close to the hole.
Yeah, yeah.
That was his attitude.
Yeah. I mean, he was made for match play as well.
Oh, my God. Nicholas said, if Ryder Cup said, rather heavy than anybody I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And how good was Curtis?
Curtis was very good, but I think Curtis was a better pro than he was an amateur.
Right.
Because Curtis used to be long.
Yeah.
Long and wild.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he could really play,
mm-hmm.
but he was wild.
Yeah. That's the opposite of what he became.
Oh, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I say I think he was a better pro than he was an amateur. Not that he didn't have a hell of an amateur record, but he, you know, he learned how to control his game and his golf ball.
Yeah, yeah.
And God, no, you're talking about a hard ass player. Oh. I mean, you didn't want any part of Curtis.
No. I remember he said to me once. I mean, he and I get on well, which is on the face of it, you know, it shouldn't really happen. But he said to me once, he says, you know why we get on well? You've got some vinegar in you, and so have I.
Now,
you know?
Curtis is a good guy. I see a ton of his twin brother, Alan.
Yeah.
We play a lot of golf together. But I'm a big fan of Curtis.
Yeah.
Always have.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. He made the mistake of not coming to the Open as well, by the way.
Yeah.
1985,
yeah.
when he was the best player in the world, he played in the Dutch Open.
Yeah.
The following week for appearance money. No, I couldn't approve of that. So, again, I want any more top amateurs that come to mind? How good was Manalik? Great short game.
Michael was a great competitor. I mean, I would not say that Michael was a great player. I mean, when I look at, you know, when I go back to a Harvey Ward or I look at a Curtis or a Crenshaw or a Lanny as amateurs, you know, I mean, in a fair fight, I don't think Michael would stack up to him at all. Now, he's a wonderful man, and I'm not belittling him.
No.
But, I'm trying to give you an honest answer.
Yeah. It wasn't impressive to look at.
No.
And Michael, but my goodness, he could play, though.
Oh, yeah. No, Michael. Well, Michael could do what is the key to the game. He'd get in the hole quickly.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, that was the key. I mean, look at his record. I mean, you can't argue with his record.
I touched on, the 75 Walker Cup. I've just had a story published about that, which you were part of. And I was making the claim that that was the best American Walker Cup team ever. For the moment, at least. It might be passed later on by a couple of teams. But how did you feel about that? And what was that like at the time? Did you realize at the time?
I thought your column was perfect. I love being part of the best team they've ever had. I mean, you cited the two teams I would say were spectacular.
Yeah.
The one at Marion and I guess at County Down.
Yeah.
And the LA team that Spider and I,
Spider
and I had a little go at each other. Spider said, "Well, we just tied your record." I said, "No, you did not tie a record. You won 19 points. We won 19 points.
Right.
When I was a captain.
Right. Of course, yeah.
I said, but you lost 7 points. We only lost 5 points.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, right.
Yeah. That was 93 when you were captain.
93, at Interlochen.
That was a good British team, by the way. If you look at it now, a huge number of them went on to play on tour.
I think Harrington was the oldest guy on the team.
Yeah. He played in three Walker Cups.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, you just got to look at the records, and they've still got time to prove you wrong.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. And I've couched it as, at least for now, it's the best team.
Yeah, that's right. No, I think that's right. But I mean, when I look at the top of that team that you cited, that was a hell of a team.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and some guys that, I mean, look at Jay Haas's record.
Mm.
Jay Haas, I think, has made more cuts than anybody in the history of golf.
he's up there.
And he's amassed a lot of retirement points.
Yes, I'm sure he has. He'll not have to work again, I don't think.
No. Yeah. I just saw him. I went to Gary Koch's Payne Stewart Award ceremony in Atlanta, and Jay was there. He's fighting back problems.
Is he?
Like most of us.
Like all of us, I wanted to ask you about the... You know, you've been around a long time. That goes without saying.
Yes, I have.
The game as it's evolved at the top level in terms of equipment, distance, all that stuff. Where do you sit on that argument? or debate.
You have to go with the fact that technology is as good as it is. I think it's a shame. You see very few players that really know how to play shots anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, bomb and gouge, they talk about. I mean, when you look at it, they hit it 340 yards. They hit it in the rough. The rough's cut short. The greens are soft. The greens putt the same speed every week. They throw a wedge up on the green. They got a 20-footer, which to us playing 30, 40 years ago, a 20-footer was a 20-footer. Now a 20-footer is a 10-footer because the greens are perfect. And I just don't see the same – I honestly don't see the same skill level. Mm-hmm. We talk all the time, but we played swinging at 80% most of the time.
Yeah.
They don't know what 80% is.
No.
They don't know that there's a sweet spot in a golf club.
See, I don't question their skill level. I just question the fact that they never have to use it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No, I mean, you've got guys that, you know, you still got people that really can hit golf shots. But at the same time, just what you said, they don't have to very often. Yeah.
As long as you've got that one shot.
Yeah. There's very little flighting of the ball.
Yeah.
It's very little working of the ball. I mean, if you hit a right-to-left shot, you got a back right pin, you set it in the right bunker and hit a little soft draw in there.
Yeah.
God, talk to Lanny about it sometime.
Oh,
it drives him crazy.
Yeah.
But again, I just wish they – I mean, the ball thing, who knows? I don't think they can do anything about it. But they could take the driver head and cut it down from 460 to 400 or 380.
Yeah, there's ways of doing it. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. I mean, to me, they don't. Mm-hmm. They think inside the box, not outside the box.
Yeah. And they come to this is the ultimate monument.
Yeah.
To golf, this place where we are, the old course, and they don't play the old course anything like it. It
no.
should be played.
I said to somebody today. I said, based on the weather forecast I saw now, I know the weather can change in 5 minutes around here, but it's an American golf course right now. The greens, because you've had rain, the greens are receptive, and they're hitting 9 hours of wedges all the time.
Yeah.
And greens are beautiful. We played here Tuesday and Wednesday, and, I mean, the greens are smooth. They putt well. They will hold a golf shot.
Yeah. Did you not find there was more long grass out there than there's ever been before?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
which I find unforgivable.
Yeah,
on that course, you know.
It's just a different game, and I will 100% agree. They're better athletes.
Mm-hmm.
They're stronger. I mean, you know, you got a fitness trailer at every place. Every one of them's got a home gym and six trainers. And,
yeah, yeah.
You know, then they'll fight over who's got the best trainer.
No.
You know, you come to Florida and it's Joey D over here and it's so-and-so over there and it's somebody else over here. And, you know, they're almost getting a fight over whose trainer you use. It's crazy.
That, but you're right.
It is.
Yeah.
No. They'll tell a trainer, if you're going to work with me, you can't work with so-and-so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Where do you sit on the state of professional golf right now, if I can put it that way?
Well,
where are we headed? What do you think?
I think, as we touched on it earlier, John, I think we've lost the competitive edge of the game because it's money.
Hmm.
I think this live thing is horrible. I mean, I am 108,000%, if you can go over 100, opposed to having anything to do with that group of people. And it's not because of Greg Norman or Phil Mickelson or whatever. It's not good for golf.
No.
The game, to me right now, and a lot of it had to do with COVID, is in the best place it's ever been. More people are playing. Memberships, clubs that were going broke are now solvent. I think people are really enjoying watching the top players. You didn't have to have Tiger Woods anymore to make it interesting. The television broadcasting's gone to hell.
Yeah.
When they let Coke and Maltby and these guys go and bring in unknowns. I mean, they've gone from pros to amateurs.
That was an inexplicable decision for me.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible. But it's just not good for the game.
I don't think anybody walks into the room that they're all in at the moment how many people are in there actually thinking, let's do what's best for the game?
No.
They've all got their own agenda.
It's all money.
Yeah.
It's totally money-driven. And I will say, I mean, I guess all the Saudis have to do is open another oil pipe and they can pay for anything they want to.
Yeah.
But if the players had any feeling of self-worth, you know, we don't, we've got certainly the top players. What would you say? 30, 40, 50?
Yeah.
They got more money than they ever spent.
Yeah, exactly. When does it stop mattering?
Yeah. I mean, play to win majors. Play to win tournaments. Mm. If you only got $3 million instead of $5 million to win a tournament, what difference does it make?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think you've got some guys like that. I think Rory McIlroy is in that camp. I think Rory would be just as happy winning the Masters, happier winning the Masters for a dollar than for $100 million.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't need the
money.
He
might quit if he won the Masters.
Possibly, yeah. Go away and make babies.
But, you know, there's some really good guys out there, but they've got to get together and say, what is best for the game?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know. The game's been pretty damn good to us.
Yeah.
What do we do to make it better?
I hear you, and I agree with you, but I don't hear many people saying
it isn't going to happen. I mean, I'm afraid of not even thinking about it happening.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to get cynical about it all, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I won't say it's heartbreaking, but it's disappointing. Mm-hmm. It really is.
I want to finish off by coming full circle, and I'm going to press you on this a little bit. Your best golf... Yeah, we talked about you didn't turn pro and you still don't know 100%, blah, blah, blah. But your best golf, and we twist your arm up your back, where would that have put you on tour, do you think? Honest assessment.
I think I could have probably made a Ryder Cup team. Mm. I felt like I had the type of game that I could win a major because
mm-hmm.
I could get out of trouble with it.
Absolutely.
And make a par when I ought to make a bogey.
Mm-hmm.
Could I have, you know, I mean, that's nice of Curtis to say he'd been in the Hall of Fame. I have no clue about that.
Yeah, I don't see you dominating, but I see
you making a very nice living. I think I could have been a top 25 player.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think that's fair. Where from there, I don't know.
Yeah. So
I mean, I used to be a great putter. So, I mean, you know, God, if you can putt, you can get away with murder.
Yeah, yeah.
Can't putt a lick anymore.
No? Have you had to go in the Himalayas while you were here?
I just finished playing
We
just finished. Dick Sidorov and his wife and my wife and I played.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
Yeah. Well, I used to work beside Topsy at Golf Digest. She was there for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's a great lady.
Topsy's tough on that Himalayas.
Is she?
She won't give you a one-foot putt.
Anyway, this week, Walker, you're going to be attending a Walker Cup. When you watch these guys now, what takes your eye or catches your eye? What are you looking for in these young lads?
I want to see what they can do when they get a gun to the head. I like to see them, you know, let's say a guy's two down going to 14 here. Show me what you got.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Can you suck it up? I mean, the other guy might choke a little bit.
Yeah.
You got to hope he does.
Absolutely.
But more importantly, can you make him choke?
Yeah.
You know, people used to give Johnny Miller hell for saying choke all the time, and I don't disagree with that.
Yeah.
But, hey, we all do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very last question is, you mentioned the Ryder Cup there. What do you make of the Ryder Cup and what it's become? I talked to Gary Cook about this yesterday, and he kind of shares my misgivings a little bit about it.
I think the Ryder Cup is, well, again, it's about money, too.
Yeah.
I mean, when I said last night to somebody, I said, it's a shame that, and I have to say, mostly over here, you buy a Ryder Cup.
Hmm. Oh, yeah.
Or you go
it's a rich
to,
man's toy.
Yeah. I mean, you go to Rome. I talked to a friend of mine who was just over there, and they played five golf courses, and they said that was the worst of the five.
I don't hear anything good about it.
The thing they played in France looked like some goofy, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. ball would go into grass. You couldn't find yourself, much less your ball. I remember I went to the 97 Ryder Cup at Valderrama when Seve was the captain because Tom Kite was the captain. He was a client of ours.
Yeah.
And, I mean, on the 17th hole, Seve put rough in the middle of the fairway at 290 yards because his guys couldn't get to it and the Americans could. Yeah. I mean, you know, but I still think it's pretty neat competition.
Oh, it's wonderful.
I still think
yeah.
it's really
at
fun
its core.
To watch.
Yeah.
And you have to applaud the European team. They seem – and I think camaraderie is a big part of mm-hmm. it. You know, they got a team and we got 10 individuals.
Yeah, mind you, there's a fair bit going on behind the scenes that you never hear about.
I'm sure.
They do a good job of keeping it under wraps.
I'm sure because they're all spoiled brats. I mean, you got 24 spoiled brats out there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I look at this year and when you look at the strength of the top of the European team mm-hmm. and then you look at the picks, I mean, I know Fitzpatrick's going to be one of the picks. I mean, one of the best players in the world.
Yeah.
So I think it's – I still think – I love watching it. Mm-hmm. I mean, my favorite thing –
when it's close.
Yeah. My favorite thing to watch in golf is the Open Championship.
Okay.
And I hate it when the weather's good because I want to see them struggle a little bit. Yeah.
But well, that's what made me ask why you never came and played in it.
Well, you know, that was 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You learn a lot in 50 years.
Well, that's true. It's the old story, isn't it? Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Nothing truer. Yeah. Vinny, I've kept you long enough. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate it very much. It's always fun to be with you. Yeah. And as long as I'm lucid, if I can help let me know.
You're way more than that. Thank you again for your time.
Great. Cheers.
What a fascinating peek, not only into the life of one of the game's great amateurs, but a rare behind-the-scenes look at that whole other world of golf, the business side. It's got almost nothing to do with hitting fairways or holing putts, but as 2024 gets underway, it continues to dominate talk about the top levels of the men's game. As always, a big thanks to both Huggy and guest Vinny Giles for investing the time to record that chat. That wraps up episode 110 of the pod, but make sure you've hit the follow button because on our next, it's John Huggan again, but this time with an Irish tinge.
You know, anyone who's had the privilege and pleasure of playing down Australia knows the whole sort of Melbourne sand. And so every golf course is basically just a sort of what you'd love a links to look like, just with better weather.
That's regular visitor to Australia in decades past, Ronan Rafferty, next time on The Thing About Golf.